Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me, for the first time, is Jacob Haller. Did I have that name right?
Haller.
Jacob Haller. See, I'll edit that, and it'll sound like I knew exactly what I was talking about.
I got it.
So Jacob, introduce yourself, please, and tell everyone out there where they could hear you elsewhere.
Sure. I'm a podcaster as well and a musician. The main podcast that I appear on or co-host currently is one called Love You Like Crazy. That's Love YA Like Crazy, and it's about young adult fiction. Me and my co-host Carrie talk about it and rant and swear and whatnot. I've been listening to Sophomore Lit for a bit, and it occurred to me recently that I actually remembered a bunch of the books that I read for one particular class. So I wrote to John and suggested that I come on, and he very kindly agreed.
Yes. Well, one of the stories that you suggested was the story we are ending up doing, which is William Faulkner's 1942, The Bear. But as we discovered, I knew that this had been published separately from the collection Go Down Moses, which Faulkner insists is a novel, and readers can make up their own mind if they want to go back and read the entirety of Go Down Moses, of which The Bear is the longest story. But I was not aware of how very different this version from Go Down Moses is from the short story that was published originally in Saturday Evening Post. Strangely enough, in the same year, in 1942, it's just that Faulkner was working on the two sort of simultaneously. And going back and reading it again, I am about, as I was saying, as we were talking beforehand, I'm about 100% sure that this is not, Go Down Moses' version is not the version you would have been assigned in high school.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of funny because we had some back and forth, and you said, well, how about The Bear? And I'm like, yeah, sure, let's do that. And you said, the version from Go Down Moses, right? And I'm like, oh yeah, sure, of course. And then I started reading it, and the version that's in the Saturday Evening Post takes up about, I think it's like a sixth of the length of the overall story in, you know, the version that's in Go Down Moses. So when I was reading the Go Down Moses version, I was like, okay, I remember all this part, the part with the bear. That's the part I remember. And then there's a part where the bear is killed. And I was like, well, I don't really remember this part, but sure, I guess I just don't remember it. And then it goes on to this long series where he's going through ledgers, and that takes up as much of, you know, like that's half the book is chapter four, where he's sort of going through ledgers and having these long arguments about, am I going to stay on the plantation? Am I leaving? And so on. And I was like, what in hell is this? And so, like, the first time reading, I was like, wait, when does this end? Because it's not the last story in Go Down Moses. And it was a little bit of torture, but then I went back and read the whole thing again. And knowing, you know, with my expectations altered, I actually enjoyed the whole thing quite a bit more on that final reread. But yeah, it was a little surprise for me.
Right. Now, the version that gets taught in high schools, the version from the Saturday Evening Post, was, I from what I understand, from what little I've read online, it was a version that Faulkner got together because he needed the money really quickly. He needed to sell a story, and the Saturday Evening Post, he pulled together the most, I think, accessible part of the story of the young boy being introduced into the world of hunting in the world of the men who go on the hunt in his in this hunting ground that's run by this guy named Major Despain. And one of the things that's very different about this short story is Faulkner explains who everybody is very carefully right away at the beginning of the story. So you're not confused. You're not confused the way that you are when you're reading Faulkner normally, like if you're reading The Sound and the Fury or Absalom, Absalom, or any of the Faulkner that gives Faulkner the reputation of being an extremely dense and extremely difficult author. The Saturday Evening Post story isn't what I would call sweet, but it is kind of a boy's adventure story.
Yeah, and it kind of lays out the moral at the end in the way that doesn't really happen in the Go Down Moses version. Like at the very end, the boy is, you know, there's this mythical bear, a giant bear that's older than the boy is. And so he gets a chance to shoot it, but he doesn't do it. And so then he like kind of tries to figure out why he didn't do it and like what that says about him. And his father reads him Keats's Ode to on a Grecian Urn and says, you know, the perfection of the chase. That's what, you know, that's what this whole thing is about. And that's why you didn't take the shot, even though you could have. And that's more or less where that version of the story ends, right? Yeah, so that's like, that's catnip for English, you know, for high school English class. It's like, here's the moral. It's got this classical reference, you know.
It has this very simple, you know, almost quaint vision of gentlemen hunters out who are chasing after this bear, and we're told that they never are going to capture this bear. They never intend to capture this bear because the bear in some way is beyond all of them, and being out there in the woods it's just an excuse for them to go back every year into the woods. And as you mentioned, the bear is not killed in the original in this Saturday Evening Post story, and the boy is not even named in this Saturday Evening Post story, and we don't get to see much more about his life, and we certainly don't get to see him grow up to become a disenchanted and distressed young adult, learning all the horrible truths about his grandfather, which is what makes up the rest of the story in Go Down Moses, and which is what in Go Down Moses we are only given the boy's name like halfway through the story. We're given it as Ike, but if you have been reading Go Down Moses up to this point, you probably will have guessed who we're talking about, because this is Isaac McCaslin, who is the central character of the rest of the stories in this book.
Yes, which I haven't read, but I did read the Wikipedia article though. So,
well, you know, that's that. I was thinking about this because I remember reading this. I was assigned the bear in its Go Down Moses form in my freshman year in college. In we had a basic humanities core that we had to take. I had a very strange college that had a trimester system, and I believe this was in the second trimester of that year we had to read this. And I remember just being utterly perplexed as to what happened in the story when you get that break after the bear, whose name is Old Ben, is in fact killed, and then we pick up Isaac's life afterwards, and there's one of these Faulknerian changes in narrative voice and change in perspective, and it's very, very confusing if you haven't read any other Faulkner. Now, with the hindsight of having gone to graduate school and broken my brain on several Faulkner novels, it seems all of a piece to me. But Yeah, but yeah, it is a confusing, a very confusing story to read, I think, in isolation. And now I wonder why my professors had me read it in isolation.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can only speak for myself. I did, the first time through this version, as I said, I was baffled and enraged. But the second time, it all made sense, a lot more sense to me, and I really felt like I got a lot out of it. Because, the first part of the story is like this sort of adventure story that is from the memory of Isaac when he's 10 to 16 years old, basically. Right. And then it goes forward, and it's kind of like at that point, the first time through, I'm like, why am I reading all these ledger entries? Like, what has happened to the bear? Well, I guess the bear died. I knew that, but then it's kind of like this other way of telling a story where if you look at these ledger entries, they tell a story, and Isaac himself, kind of decodes a bunch of it for you and like figures out that his grandfather, essentially had raped one of his slaves and then further raped that slave's daughter, his own daughter, causing the mother to commit suicide on Christmas Day. And it's all told through these simple ledger entries, saying when people were born, when they died, who they married, and so on. And that's like a much more sort of, that's like, that is your kind of adult version of the adventure story where you like go through the things, you figure it out, and you learn it. So the second time I read it through, I liked that whole contrast quite a bit.
It's important to note that when you get to the second section, it really does become Faulknerian in that Faulkner intentionally confuses the reader. The Faulkner is really wanting to slow the reader down. Readers who've read The Sound of the Fury know that there's a character in that book called Candace, who everyone calls Caddy, and at the very beginning of the novel, there is reference to a golf caddy. And so from the get-go, there's this intentional confusion between names. And that's happening here too. We don't get Isaac. Isaac doesn't get named until about halfway through the book, or the short story. He's Isaac McCaslin. He has a long conversation in the middle of the story with his cousin, whose name is McCaslin Edmonds, and so his cousin is referred to as McCaslin as well. And you're having to figure out which McCaslin we're talking about. On top of that, his cousin was the one who raised him pretty much from youth. His father was remote. His father was one of these twin brothers, Buck and Buddy, and they're referred to as Uncle Buck and Uncle Buddy, in spite of the fact that Uncle Buck is the birth father for Isaac. So there's a lot of confusion going on here. On the other side of the class divide in this story, part of this story takes place before the Civil War in flashbacks. Part of the story takes place after the Civil War, and the former slaves of his grandfather, Crothers McCaslin, have now got their bloodline, because of these rapes, mixed up with the McCaslin family. And part of what Isaac is discovering here is he is trying to untangle the horror of what's happened, not simply that his grandfather raped one of his slaves, but then raped the offspring of that rape. And Isaac is trying really hard to do right by these people, trying to administer a trust to these descendants who are, after all, his cousins as well. And so that's part of what you have to tease out there.
To return to the moment when he figures out that his grandfather had sex with his own daughter, like, kind of the way that happens is, like, first he figures out that he, you know, that he had had a child by the daughter, not realizing that they were related immediately. And he kind of has this sort of internal dialogue where he's, like, trying to make that okay, in an argument that is kind of familiar to people on Twitter, perhaps, where it's like, well, you know, it was a different time, and he's an old man, he's living in the house by himself, this woman comes, like, maybe they get, you know. But then he realizes that it's also incest, and that the mother then committed suicide, and then he's like, well, no, this is just, like, there's no way I can excuse this in any way. And I feel like that's kind of a thing that happens a few times in this section, where and throughout the book, I think, where, although, am I going to remember other examples? Maybe not, but where it's like, where he just sort of realizes the inherent corruption of the situation that's around him and just wants no part of it. Whereas his cousin McCaslin, is more kind of apt to say, you know, well, we are where we are, and let's just sort of move forward from here.
Right.
Knowing that the Civil War has happened and the slaves have been freed, and, you know, so maybe we can just move forward.
One way that this story feels different to me than other Faulkners that I've read, a novel like Absalom is dealing with the legacy of slavery. But it doesn't make as explicit reference to the Civil War as this short story does. The short story actually dwells for a while on actual historical events from the Civil War, which was a little surprising to me, because Faulkner is always kind of oblique about these things. This story is Faulkner being, I think, about as explicit as he's going to be, whereas if you read his earlier stuff, he will make hints at incest or hints at miscegenation, but this is him, like, just like putting all the cards on the table. Now you may be shocked. Listeners may be wondering, what the heck does hunting a bear have to do with the aftermath of slavery? If the short story, as it was in Saturday Evening Post, is a kind of a clean moral about the glories of nature, and this is a story about what happens afterward. Old Ben, the mythical bear of the title, who seems to have lived in the woods forever and has been forever poaching livestock from the neighboring farms and poaching grain from silos, and when they finally do catch up with Old Ben, the only thing that brings Old Ben to heel is this semi-feral dog named Lion, who just shows up one day. He seems about as wild as Old Ben is, and he is tamed by this huntsman named Sam Fathers, who is part
it says he's a son of a Chickasaw chief and a slave, I believe.
In Faulkner's world, that would be, he's more primitive and more attuned to nature, and I apologize for that, but that is the sort of the implication of it. But Sam is the huntsman who knows what to do, and he says, we don't want to tame Lion, we just want him on our side.
Yeah, and also another character who's kind of key to bringing down Old Ben in the end is Boone Hagenbeck, who is a quarter Chickasaw, it says, and 6'4", and it says in the book, has the mind of a child.
The sequence in which Lion trees Old Ben and takes him to ground, allowing Boone to come in and stab him with his knife, is really very grisly. If any of you listeners out there remember Mystery Science Theater from the Sci-Fi Channel days, there was a skit where Tom Servo and Crow were playing Dog and Bear. And it's basically this scene from The Bear.
It's very bloody. Lion is almost immediately eviscerated. Ed Boon, who has formed this kind of strange bond with Lion, is then emboldened to go in and stab him and takes a lot of damage himself.
It's this is not a romantic view of the hunt. This is kind of about as brutal. This is kind of like Faulkner doing Hemingway. With the death of old Ben, basically the McCaslins sort of decide, oh, that's it, closing up shop. This hunting ground gets pretty much almost immediately next year sold off to a logging company. And the hunters all say, like, well, we'll come back together. We'll be sure to meet up again. We'll write a clause in that we still have hunting rights. But of course, it ends. Basically, it's the end of an era. And
yeah.
So if you want to talk, you know, symbols, which are, as I've said before, like what I think people love to hang on in intro to literature classes. If old Ben represents the wilderness, you know, once he's dead, that's when civilization comes in the form of land development, and the railroad is coming in. Basically, everything has changed. Later in the story, when Isaac comes back to the woods, he notes how much everything has changed.
Yeah, we should also note that Sam Fathers has a stroke or something. You know, basically at the instant the bear is killed, Sam Fathers dies as well. Well, actually, he has a stroke, and then it seems like perhaps Boone Hagenbeck kills him at his request a few days later and buries him next to Lion and with the paw of the bear
right
on his chest.
Right.
And the... So, not to digress too quickly from what you were talking about, but one thing that struck me about that whole situation is they call a doctor because, you know, Lion, Boone, and Sam have all been stricken in one way or another. And the doctor comes, treats the dog first, although that's at Boone's insistence, then treats Boone, and then goes in and basically kind of has a look at Sam Fathers and is like, yeah, he'll be fine, and then leaves. You know, I think that there's a commentary there on how the various races are looked at and treated in this, you know, at this point in society, right?
Definitely, definitely. And also, all of the African American characters are referred to by the nomenclature of the mother's name apostrophe the child. So we're early on we're told that one of the people at the camp is Tenny's Jim, and later we learn about Tommy's Turl, who's the offspring of the of the rape between Carruthers McCaslin and Tommy. And this nomenclature gets used even though this is the story starts in the 1870s. The Civil War has been over now for about 20 years at this point, but still the class structures are in place, and certainly the social conventions are still in place from slavery. Not much has changed. It's good you point out all the stuff about Sam's death and everything, because the other thing about this section of the book is it's so highly wrought. There's like it's almost operatic, the hunt and the importance of the hunt and the mythical nature of Ben and the mythical nature of Lion. Everything here is almost magical realism, and then suddenly it's over. And once that's all over, the world of civilization is very commonplace and very and not operatic, and it's a world of ledgers and of Isaac having to piece together his family history by reading these little notes between his father and his father's brother in this ledger. Isaac wants no part of it. You know, he discovers that you know, that civilization carries with it the guilt of his family and the debt that he feels he owes to the offsprings of Tommy, including Jim and Lucas, and there's a daughter named Fonseba, who is married off to this guy who shows up and takes her off to a cabin somewhere, and he wants to, and Isaac wants to present them with the money he believes is their right from the family, and he's basically refused. So he feels the guilt of his grandfather's actions. He feels the weight of what he thinks civilization is doing, and he feels like the whole idea of land ownership is absurd on its face.
Right.
He becomes kind of prophetic. You know, his talk is all very biblical. He decides he's going to become a carpenter because Jesus was a carpenter. So sure, I'll become a carpenter.
Yes. And Faulkner is careful to say that, you know, he's not trying to be like Jesus. He's just being like, well, if it's good enough for Jesus, then I guess it's good enough for me too.
Yeah.
Which is a subtle distinction that I don't know about. But,
Faulkner's sentences are always in the form of, it was not that X, nor was it that Y, nor even that Z, but rather that, and then A prime or something, you know, and that this is the way Faulkner has this highly elevated style that takes over whenever the third person narrator gets a crack at the action. That's not all the time. Quite frequently, the story is just told through dialogue back and forth or memories or these ledger things. But when the third person narrator encroaches, it's always this analytic, almost obsessive voice that's trying to make very careful distinctions about what it's talking about. It's a confusing narrative voice, but I love it. And actually, I just want to point out, I mentioned when we did Absalom, that Absalom has one of my favorite Faulknerian sentences ever, and it was at the very beginning. It was about a whole paragraph long in one sentence, and it's one of these sentences that's warning you as a reader, watch out, you're going to have to really pay close attention. And similarly, at the very beginning of The Bear, there's this wonderful sentence that goes like this.
It was of the men, not white nor black nor red, but men, hunters, with the will and hardihood to endure and the humility and skill to survive, and the dogs and the bear and deer juxtaposed and relieved against it, ordered and compelled by and within the wilderness in the ancient and unremitting contest according to the ancient and unmitigable rules which voided all regrets and brooked no quarter. The best game of all, the best of all breathing and forever the best of all listening. The voice is quiet and weighty and deliberate for retrospection and exactitude among the concrete trophies. The racked guns and the heads and the skins, in the libraries of townhouses or the offices of plantation houses, or, and best of all, in the camps themselves where the intact and still warm meat yet hung, the men who had slain it sitting before the burning logs on hearths when there were houses and hearths, or about the smoky, blazing, piled wood in front of stretched tarpaulins when there were not.
And so that's a little that's a little indication of where you're headed in this story. That sentence does not occur in the Saturday Evening Post version.
Yeah. Is that? Well, that's true. And there's this kind of idea, you know, this ideal that you've spoken of hunting as this pursuit in which basically all men are equal. Obviously, women do not enter into this at all. But it's also, and that is really pretty literally in the Saturday Evening Post version. Like, there isn't a lot that questions that in that version of the story. But in the in this version of the story, there's some things questioning it from the very beginning, because the very first paragraph that I see is there was a man and a dog too this time, two beasts counting old Ben the bear, and two men counting Boone Hagenbeck, in whom some of the same blood ran which ran in Sam Father's, even though Boone's was a plebeian strain of it, and only Sam and old Ben and the mongrel lion were taintless and incorruptible. And so, you know, this idea of different blood and how it is viewed is built into the story from the beginning in this version of the story.
No, definitely. The bloodlines are central to Faulkner. And this is, you know, this is the great conflict in Faulkner, who was a huge critic of the South and of the slave trade and of the history of the South and of the South's sense of its own importance, but who nonetheless internalized that Southern ideal of bloodlines, you know, because the only way that chattel slavery works is if you make very clear legal distinctions about who can be a slave and who is not a slave. And it all comes down to this sort of like one drop of blood thing makes you black in the South, and or at least historically so. And it's And while Faulkner is critical of that point, I think he internalizes that too, you know, because he's obsessed with the idea of bloodlines. You know, what this book, certainly Absalom, are stories about the intermixing of white and black bloodlines, and in a way to challenge the idea of the supremacy of blood. But on the other hand, he's still buying into these categories.
Yeah, I mean, so Isaac and McCaslin have this long argument that makes up the bulk of chapter 4, the longest chapter of this book. And Isaac sort of makes the argument that black people or slaves or ex-slaves in general are superior to white people in that, or at least have more potential than white people because they don't have the same kind of weight of sin. I don't know. Is this a true thing I'm saying? Maybe.
Yes,
not,
I think that, I think that's a good summary of Isaac's point.
And then, whereas McCaslin, refers to the ex-slaves as the sons of Ham, which is referencing Genesis 9:20, where Noah gets drunk and is naked, and Ham, who's the father of Canaan, sees that he's naked, goes and tells his brother because he thinks it's hilarious, I guess. And the two brothers go in and they walk in backwards so that they won't see their father and his foolishness and cover him. And then it says, and Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done unto him. And he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. And Isaac's like, yeah, I don't think that that's a real story. That's basically what Isaac says about that.
That actually, though, was one of the traditional ways in which people justified slavery, was this biblical interpretation of the Noah story. It was a very different world.
Yeah, although some, you know, those people are still around too.
Sometimes we refer to this as a book, and sometimes we refer to it as a story. This is a section of this group of stories that Faulkner decided to call a novel, and in itself, it's as long as a short novel. What you want to call it will depend upon your perspective. I suppose if you are going to commit to reading all of Go Down Moses, you know, you could call these sections, I don't know, chapter sections. It's confusing.
The Bear itself has chapters. It has 5 chapters.
I feel when I read Faulkner that he was trying really hard to do the best he could by his Black characters, but it's sort of like when you read Huckleberry Finn.
Yes.
There's a certain limitation here that comes from stereotypes and expectations about race differences.
I also kind of wonder, like, if you were, let's see, this was written in 42. Yeah. I mean, I think that maybe, you know, as, and even more so with Twain, like as a white man in the South, there is one Black character in this book who is described as speaking like a white man. And that's the guy who marries, what's her name? Fonseba. And McCaslin sort of treats with him on that level, although Ossol is kind of condescending to him in a way, whereas somewhat surprisingly to me, and maybe you can explain this to me, Isaac is just infuriated.
Well, Isaac feels protective of Fonseba because he's discovered that she is basically second cousin to him. And he's trying to work out what that means, what his responsibility is for her. And so he sees this other person, this other man, as like a suitor he doesn't know who's going to come and take her away. And the other thing about it is the suitor shows up and says, I don't have to say anything to you. You don't own her. You know, I'm just letting you know out of politeness that she's coming off to live with me now. And what it is it's making explicit this change of position brought about by emancipation. I think Isaac feels offended, not because he feels he owns Fonseba, but he feels, you know, paternal towards her in a way that's probably inappropriate, to be honest. He feels that responsibility. He feels, and that's because in his mind, it's again that the imagination of blood, of blood relation. He feels that she's owed a part of the family fortunes, you know, and, yeah. And he's right about that, but she doesn't want anything to do with him. She doesn't want anything to do with him. She doesn't care about his sense of propriety or his sense of protection. She wants to go off and have a life, you know, with the guy mm-hmm. that she's chosen to be with. And Isaac is sort of unable to let that go, I think.
Yeah. I mean, he goes out and finds them, which it sounds like takes some time and effort. And finds them on this farm in the middle of nowhere, and it seems like the farm is failing and it's not going to work, but they refuse any help, and he asks her, you know, mostly he talks to her husband, but then he says, Fonseba, are you all right? And her answer is, I'm free.
Right.
And she just wants no part of him or his family. Right. Although
I actually think that this is this is the one part where I actually thought Faulkner was being, was acknowledging his limitations. You know, he ultimately, Fonseba's story is beyond this story, and she, whether or not the farm is going to succeed or fail, whether or not she's going to have a happy marriage, she has already extricated herself from the McCaslins, and that's a victory. And it's a victory that ultimately has nothing to do with Isaac or anyone in the story. and that's I think a great thing. Now the other reason I kind of want to bring up Fonsipa is this is a very male story. There are
yes.
it's almost entirely men. Fonsipa is one woman who gets to talk. We get reference to these women who were raped by Carruthers Macassan, but there is also Isaac's eventual wife, who is, I think,
that's a crazy scene.
Yeah, not a great character.
Well, no,
her main thing is she doesn't understand why Isaac would repudiate his birthright, particularly, you know, give up the entire plantation. She feels you're crazy, you're insane, and she tries to get him to take it back by having sex with him, which in this kind of a creepy, weird, you know, like Faulkner is writing about sex sort of the way, you know, an alien might describe sex between humans. And the thing that's really weird about her is I think that we're, as readers, are supposed to see her as, as some sort of a corrupting influence in Isaac's life, who's going to try to get Isaac to go back on his noble pledge to give up his land or something. I don't know, but I just don't feel like Faulkner really... Faulkner can't be bothered to actually write a real female character here, and that's unfortunate, because Faulkner has written some okay female characters, including the previously mentioned Candace Compson from Sound of the Fury. I think is a Caddy Compson is a great character, but here he just seems to have sort of disgust for the whole act of sex, I guess.
Well, I have a question. I guess this is a general question about this sort of thing, like, where, because these different sections are kind of tied pretty closely to Isaac's point of view, right? So, like, when he's a 10-year-old, it's told from this with this sort of 10-year-old sense of wonder and excitement and stuff. And then, so I guess, like, kind of the temptation is to say that this is how Isaac feels about this character and not necessarily how Faulkner does or how you're supposed to, but that also feels like a total cop-out. In this case, I feel like I lean towards cop-out, where in other cases that argument might be more convincing. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's in other books, certainly in a book like As I Lay Dying, which is I would actually recommend anyone who's interested in reading Faulkner, I would say read As I Lay Dying first. It's a short novel, and it's an easy novel to understand. The point of As I Lay Dying is each short chapter in turn is told from the point of view of one of the major characters. So there you have very clear points of view. And in a novel like The Sound of the Fury, we have a third person narrator that is still closely aligned with each character in turn. There's like each section. This is a little bit harder short story to get a handle on, because as I mentioned before, you have this sort of omniscient narrator who's going to interject opinion from time to time. Mm-hmm. And then we have passages that are told very much from Isaac's memory or from inside his head. We have passages that are these passages written out in ledger. I think that it's harder to say what's happening, because it keeps shifting sort of from Isaac to the third person narrative. There is this thing I've mentioned before. It's called the free indirect style, which is when the narrative voice takes on the concerns or the opinions of one of the major characters. And this is, and everyone credits Jane Austen with having invented this in Pride and Prejudice, that we have a narrative voice that from time to time takes on the main character's point of view, Elizabeth Bennet's point of view. But it's but I don't know that the narrator is taking on Isaac's point of view all the time, this story. I think the narrator is sometimes kind of off in his or her own head or whatever. You know, the occasion for writing these things is never clear in Faulkner. You know, in the 18th century, you had novels that were made up of letters that were supposedly discovered and put together, and there's this simulation of reality. These are the actual letters that were written. This was the actual diary that someone kept. That was the way the novel was originally built. By the time we get to Faulkner, he doesn't care. You know, you can ask all you want. Who's the narrator? Who's he talking to? Why is he telling us this? And you'll never get an answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. I have another question about this scene. I feel like the book doesn't entirely say, but it's implied that this tactic on the part of his wife works, right?
Well, he never does reclaim that farm.
Well, he says yes. He said, and from there goes to chapter 5, which is a flashback, I think.
Yeah, I think the yes is he deigns to have sex with her. He tells her, that's all for me. If this don't get that son you talk about, it won't be mine. But
wonderfully written character. Yeah, absolutely.
So basically that's it for them? Is that they're going to now have a sexless marriage, I guess? I don't know. I don't like this part of Isaac. But that's okay, I guess. Isaac is not necessarily held up to be some sort of a paragon. He takes it a little too far. You know, he reminds me a lot of Quentin Compson from The Sound of the Fury and also from Absalom Absalom. Quentin is another character who just obsessively ruminates on the past and ruminates on particularly the past of the South. The conceit of Absalom Absalom is that Quentin is telling the story of the Supton family to his roommate, to Quentin's roommate as they're in Harvard, and the roommate says, "Why do you hate the South so much?" And Quentin shouts at the end, "I don't hate the South. I don't. He's trying to convince himself of this fact. I think that in the same way, Isaac is too eager to take on the sins of his grandfather and to take on sort of the burden of history on himself in a way that you can argue the problem is that nobody else is doing that in this story. Nobody else is owning up to the legacy none of the other white characters are owning up to the legacy of slavery. So Isaac feels it incumbent upon himself to do that, but he's doing it in a kind of an ineffective way. It's sort of like self-flagellation that's not really going to solve anything.
Yeah, it kind of seems like a little bit of a cop-out, or maybe not even just a little bit, like, because he goes to give $1,000 to you know, the other remaining mainline descendant of his grandfather. But in terms of what he does with the plantation, he basically gives it to his cousin to run so that he doesn't run it himself, but his cousin still does. And, you know, there's talk of how the commissary is sort of the symbol of how you've got all these people, you know, these slaves and ex-slaves when they were slaves and now ex-slaves, now that they're no longer slaves, how you still have them in thrall to do your will, make your money for you while they get essentially nothing. And that system is still in place. Like, he could either close the plantation down altogether or try to give it to one of the people who, you know, who used to run it. Like, there's this sort of what I thought was kind of a powerful symbol where he talks about how his grandfather had built this big house that he wanted the family to live in, but it never really worked and it was never really finished. And so eventually his twin sons, Isaac's father and uncle built a small log cabin and then sent the slaves to work in, or to live in, the big house, which is unfinished, has, you know, there's a missing door in back. There are windows that are covered up with boards and sheets. And that every day there's this ritual at the end of the day that all the slaves sort of go in through the front door and they count them and, you know, mark down to make sure they're all there and then nail the front door closed, even though they can still get out the back. And it's the sort of image of, like, there's 24 slaves who are each probably as responsible for whatever wealth the family has as the two people and their family, the two men and their family who live in the log cabin. And yet they have nothing and you know, have no comfort or anything.
Right.
This is
very, very like the, again, very like the plot of Absalom. Absalom, which is the story of Thomas Supton trying to create his plantation, Supton's Hundred, which is basically a big swamp that he's going to create this huge plantation sort of out of force of will. He also has problems with his bloodline, and in the end of Absalom, he's failed to create the legacy that he thought he would, and the only remaining tenant at the house is a descendant of him by a slave. So this is obviously something that goes on in Faulkner's head a lot. I also wanted to point out that Thomas Supton is mentioned as one of the people who was involved in these hunts. There's also a General Compson, who is, one gathers, the grandfather of the Compsons of The Sound and the Fury. If you read a lot of Faulkner, you'll keep finding these names coming up again and again, and they all these references to Jefferson. It sounds like a real place. It's a mythical town where all the stories take place in and around.
I feel like the way that we're talking about this could make it sound like this book is a bit of a drag, but there are parts of it that are really, that I thought were, like, funny, like the whole thing with the silver cup. Isaac's uncle or father or something. Apparently I'm confused. But when Isaac was 2 weeks old, sealed $25 into a silver cup saying that Isaac should have them when he turned 21. And, you know, eventually Isaac does turn 21. He opens the cup and finds it's full of five pennies and a bunch of IOUs. And I thought that was great. I just enjoyed that a lot. I mean, as well as, like, the sort of symbolic thing about, you know, the debts unpaid by the previous generation, which maybe young people these days would relate to in some way. Lots of promises not kept. And there's also a thing which, you know, is a combination of funny and horrifying, which much is made of the fact that the grandfather only bought one slave and the rest were won or traded. And the one slave that was bought, there's just like a series of entries in the ledger between the two twins kind of talking to each other, like trying to figure out what, you know, what to do with this guy, because, like, they buy him. The idea is that he's a good bookkeeper, so they try to put him to work as a bookkeeper, and there's an entry that's like, nope, not a good bookkeeper, you know, and then they just keep going through, and then eventually they're like, okay, we're just gonna set him free, and then they're like, well, he's not leaving, so now what do we do, you know? And it's a little bit, it sort of reminded me of Bartleby the Scrivener in a way, but it's also in this sort of backdrop of, like, this is a slave who has been purchased. You know, there's a lot of talk or a lot of mentions of, like, kind of the casual way that these human beings are kind of traded around and dealt with. And this is the one case where they actually bought someone. Percival Brownlee is his name. Their increasing frustration as he turns out to not be competent at anything and then won't even leave when they try to get rid of him is... it's just, you know, as I say, a combination of funny and horrifying when you think about it.
Whether or not you find the story a drag will have to deal, on the one hand, with how much you can put up with the very horrific content of the story, you know, and you think it's the bear, it's going to be a hunting story, and maybe the worst part of it is going to be reading about a bear and a dog tearing each other apart. But that turns out not to be the worst part of the story. So whether or not you have the stomach for its horrific content is one thing. But then I think a lot of it also has to do with whether or not you have the patience to enter into Faulkner's language, which we've mentioned here. I'll be honest, I started reading Faulkner as a college student, and I read this story. I found it confusing but intriguing. And then when I got into graduate school, I developed a real love of Faulkner. But part of that has to do with the fact that I was in a writing program at the time, and I was really looking for someone who was writing in a boldly experimental way, who was going to really make the readers work at it. If I hadn't read Faulkner when I was young, I might have less patience for him now, because now that I'm older, I realize I have less interest in the idea of making a reader really work at it.
Hmm.
But as a kid in my 20s, that sounded great. That sounded like, oh yeah, give it to me. I'll try it out, you know. But I also listened to a lot of George Crumb and Stockhausen and like difficult 20th century composers when I was in my 20s, which I have not listened to in 30 odd years.
I will admit I could have used with a few less characters named McCaslin. I did, like, I had to take a lot of notes to like figure out what was going on, particularly in that fourth chapter. A question that you brought up earlier, which then I think we haven't totally discussed, is what is the story about the bear? Like, what are these stories doing in the same, or what are these chapters doing in the same story, right, or book? And I don't know. I mean, I have kind of a theory about that, which I guess I might as well just say.
Go ahead.
And then you can, a person who actually has read a lot of Faulkner and knows what you're talking about.
I know so little about what I'm talking about. You just go ahead and give your theory.
Okay. Well, I just have this sort of idea, like it's kind of bookended with, like at the very end, there's this flashback of going back, finding the lumber company, you know, tearing everything down. The locomotive has kind of impinged on this wilderness. And I do want to talk about the very end a bit, but so I feel like this, the first part is kind of like the point of view of, you know, this myth of the hunt as this area where everyone is equal, where all that matters is how good a hunter you are and how well you know the land. And there are things within it that question that a bit, but that's the basic point of view. And then at a certain point, the bear is killed and that is over. And then at that point, it becomes kind of the question of, well, like, what do you do after that myth is gone? And, you know, at that point, you no longer get to distract yourself by, like, planning out the hunt and figuring out what, you know, how you're going to get the dog and to, you know, the right dog and all that. And at that point, you kind of have to deal with the fact, the history and the fact that none of this is actually really fair. A lot of it has really horrific history behind it, and what do you do at that point? And kind of what Isaac would like to do is sort of retreat back to the wilderness, but it's not possible. The bear is dead. The wilderness is disappearing. And so, you know, you just have to kind of figure out how you want to go forward as an adult. And so that is my very pat explanation of how these different pieces fit together.
No, that sounds good to me. You mentioned the very end of the story. Are you talking about when Isaac comes back to the camp and re-encounters Boone?
Yes. Several people have been like, oh, the last couple days have, I told them that I was going to be on this podcast, and they're like, oh, what are you talking about? You know, and I said, the bear, and they're like, oh, what's it about? And so I've had to give a plot summary for this book. and so that I'm like, okay, so then the bear gets killed, and then da 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 da. And then his wife has the best sex with him of his life, and to try to convince him to move back to the plantation. And then there's a flashback where he goes to the wilderness, and then he finds Boone at the gravesite of these other people. And Boone is smashing his gun into pieces, and there's a tree with squirrels in it, and he tells Isaac, leave those squirrels alone. And that's how the book ends.
He says, leave them alone, they're mine.
Yeah.
We've seen through this story the way that Isaac has reacted to the idea of ownership of land and ownership of the wild. Here we have Boone, who was ostensibly the one who killed old Ben, although he wouldn't have done it without Lion. It's a kind of an absurd picture. I've never seen a tree with as many squirrels in it as Faulkner describes in this segment of it just being teeming with squirrels, the way that, you know, a tree can be teeming with sparrows. If you ever see a tree that is full of birds on migration, it's sort of like, mm-hmm. That's the way he's describing it. They're just like bustling and bursting out of this tree. And it is very unclear what Boone is doing with his gun, whether he's trying to destroy it or trying to fix it. It is in disarray, and he yells at Isaac, "Leave them alone, they're mine." This bizarre moment of assertion of ownership over something that he has no control over in any way. You know, he does not have the land rights to this from a legal standpoint. He doesn't actually have a gun he could shoot these squirrels with at the moment, and he doesn't. And these squirrels certainly don't really care too much about his desires one way or another.
And it seems like maybe it's significant, but I don't quite understand how that Major Despain had asked Isaac to bring a squirrel back for him.
Right.
But I don't know what that means or how that connects to any of this.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not 100 myself. Squirrels are not prize game in any way. They're like the real bottom of the barrel as far as like hunts go. You know, the stakes are so low in a way. You know, the mm-hmm. squirrels.
Yes. Right. And they're yeah. I don't know. I was attacked by a squirrel as a child, so I find them really creepy.
My wife was scratched by a squirrel, and she remembers that squirrel to this day. She feels like she was betrayed by that squirrel.
Yeah, right. This was a squirrel that I think had been in some sort of accident and was somewhat paralyzed, and so I was trying to pick it up to take it someplace, and it bit me.
Oh, Did you have to get rabies shots?
I didn't. I was wearing very thick gloves because it was in the winter, and so it didn't pierce the skin, although it made very noticeable marks. But after that, I gave squirrels a wide berth and do so to this very day. So the idea of a tree alive with squirrels is not – I would avoid that clearing. But yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying about like complicated language for – the sake of complicated language is not necessarily a thing to be admired in a story. I do have to say, like, even though the Saturday Evening Post version is simpler and more straightforward and easier to and an easier read in general, I feel like the thing that this version has there's a lot of things this version has that one doesn't, some good and some bad, but one thing that I think is good about it is just that there's a lot of stuff in the shorter version that you know, like I was like, wow, this is all really male, you know, it's all about manly men being men. There's sort of this weird idea that all people are equal on the hunt, regardless of if they're slave or free or Native American. And the thing I liked about this version of this, or one thing I liked about this version of the story is just that all of that is really questioned and, you know, and at the end, like, you don't come away from reading the story thinking, wow, hunting is the best thing.
Right.
You think, well, I don't know what you think, but that's definitely not what you think.
Right. It's amazing to think that these two stories, these two versions of the story, were published in the same year, right? Very close to each other. It was apparently, though, the lion section, the third section, was written a few years earlier. And at that point, the protagonist was going to be Quentin Compson, of Sound and Fury fame, so he would be reappearing once again as a character. Interestingly enough, got replaced by Isaac McCaslin. I think he had to be replaced because Faulkner needed to set the action of the story on either side of the Civil War, and Quentin is a character from the 1920s. So they but that does show that the original story could have been set in any time. You know, actually, when you read that Saturday Evening Post story, that could be set you know, any time you want it to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anything else?
Nope.
Okay. Great.
Thanks to my co-host, Jacob Haller. His podcast is Love You Like Crazy. The reading this time was by Kelly Guimont. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Write to the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Join the Facebook page, or join in on the Incomparable membership Slack. Coming up soon will be another special Thanksgiving episode. I hope you're enjoying your fall so far, but keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.